Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Welcome to the AI Business Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Brosnan, and today we're speaking with Heather Lane from Athena Health. Welcome, Heather. How are you?
Hi, very happy to be here. I'm doing very well this fine morning.
Why don't you start by, you know, giving us a brief background about your yourself and Athena Health?
I have been studying artificial intelligence and machine learning in one way or another since 1995. So I've seen a lot of evolution of the field. When I started, the machine learning conference was 300 people. Now it's 6,000. I got a PhD in machine learning applied to computer security in 2000, spent a couple of years as a postdoc at MIT, spent 10 years as a professor of computer science studying machine learning applied to scientific data mining problems, problems in computational biology and in computational neuroscience. And then after 10 years of that, I'd sort of burned out a little bit on academia, so I made a move to industry. I spent 5 years at Google working on their knowledge graph and some other projects related to solar power and events and, you know, making things go faster, things like that. Then in 2017, I moved to Athena Health, where I'm currently the senior architect of data science, which means that I have technical oversight of our AI technology development and sort of the technical side of the AI strategy.
Excellent. And so can you give us a little bit about Athena Health and what Athena Health does in healthcare?
Absolutely. So Athena Health is a leading provider of electronic health records and electronic revenue cycle management for the healthcare space. So we're the ones who build the software that your physicians use to record information about you as a patient and your health trajectory and your treatments and things like that. It's also the software that your physicians use to make sure they get paid, which is very important to them and very important to all of us. And we do things on that side, like making sure that prior authorizations go through so that the payers, the insurance companies, have authorized procedures before they're done. And we also do things like file bills on behalf of our healthcare providers, and we follow up in making sure that those bills get paid, things like that. We also have work in population health, where we do statistics at population levels to help inform healthcare providers about what's trending in the health of their patient base, like maybe oncoming diseases or gaps in healthcare, things like that. And we have a number of other products. We have the Hippocrates product, which is a system for providers to look up the most recent information about drugs, treatments, things like that. It's a very large business. There's a number of other facets to it, but those are a number of the key elements.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And sort of now turning towards, you know, AI and AI in healthcare, what are the current trends in AI in healthcare and specifically, you know, what is Athena Health doing with AI in healthcare?
That's a very large question and a very good one. So very broadly, AI can contribute in two major ways to healthcare. Right at the moment, there's a lot of attention on generative AI, things like ChatGPT and large language models. Those have a lot of potential that I'll come back to in a moment, but I don't want to let that eclipse a lot of the other important work that AI is doing in healthcare and that has sort of fallen out of the headlines, but is still very important. So these are things like understanding the large volumes of data that flow through. The U.S. healthcare system runs heavily on paperwork, and the providers are sort of inundated by it. So we process enormous amounts of paperwork on behalf of our providers, and being able to extract the important information out of those, put it where it needs to go, get data sorted into charts properly, all of that's very important stuff that traditionally might have been done by humans, but is expensive to do at scale with humans. And so these days we do increasing amounts of it with AI. For example, we process something like 170 million inbound faxes per year on behalf of our clients. And I know faxes, right? You know, 1987 called and wants its technology back, right? But it is a depressing truth that the fax is alive and well in the U.S. healthcare system in spite of great efforts to displace it. And I will say that that 170 million faxes a year is only a fraction of the documentation data that flows through. But even that remaining fraction is still this enormous bulk, right? So we have...
Right, and much of that data is unstructured, right? Don't they say something like 80% of healthcare data is in an unstructured format and thus, you know, doesn't get utilized?
Precisely, a major, major challenge point that, let's be honest, humans don't think in structured ways. Forcing humans to write out structured data is very much forcing humans to behave like computers, which we're not good at and we shouldn't do. So we would rather let humans interact in the way that they want to interact, which is mostly with unstructured data, and then let the computers be smart about that, which is where the AI enters. So yeah, pulling structure out of unstructured data is one major role, but there are others as well. We do things like understand the flow of claims, bills essentially, through the healthcare system, and we have predictive models to say, when do we need to poke the insurance payer to say, what's going on with this claim? Because if we poke too soon, they'll probably say something like, well, you know, it's just make our way through our systems. Don't worry about it. It will get back to you. And then they'll get annoyed for us for having called too early. But if we wait too long, maybe it got dropped on the floor somewhere. Maybe it, you know, fell into somebody's circular file. Who knows? So figuring out when the right time to follow up on that turns out to be an incredibly valuable thing to do. And that involves sort of the analytics of understanding the flow of claims through the system. But also there are things like directly helping providers do their jobs, like putting a little bit smart systems in front of them. For example, in our mobile app, we have a thing where, in mobile app, you're very constrained in screen real estate. If the provider wants to take an action, often, you know, there'll be a choice of many, many actions they could take. We surface the most relevant, most likely ones to them using fairly basic AI, but it's helpful, right? It's an accelerator. So that's an example of where even fairly basic AI, doesn't have to be as sophisticated as a language model, can still be incredibly useful to users. So there's many places where it impacts.
Some of that is sort of more, I guess we could say, traditional AI, if you will, right? Sort of predictive models and perhaps NLP applications, right? Sifting through this enormous amount of unstructured data and sort of optimizing processes.
Optimizing processes, and we like to think of it as understanding data on behalf of human beings and putting it where it needs to be, you know, in the charts so that the doctor or nurse or whoever can get to the data that they need when they need it rather than having to drill into large documents and page through them to try to find what they're looking for.
Right. And so, I mean, how would you sort of, when we look at this traditional AI element, how would you characterize sort of the state of adoption within the industry? Do you think that we're sort of reaching a peak, or we still have a lot of room to grow, or increased uptake in that regard?
I think there's still enormous possibility. And I don't like to draw too strong about a line between traditional AI and generative AI, large language model AI, because the latter is really an outgrowth of the former, and there really are close relationships there. There's a little bit more of a spectrum. But that said, I think there's still an enormous amount of low-hanging fruit in the industry as a whole that we can continue to improve and exploit using a variety of things, from very, very simple AI technologies that were understood 30 years ago, 40 years ago, to technologies that are coming out at this moment. All of them are relevant. There's so many opportunities in the space because really, as I said earlier, there's this fundamental challenge in healthcare computing and healthcare IT, which is that healthcare is a very complicated space and it's a very human space. It's dominated by human concerns and by human judgments and by interpersonal interactions between physicians and patients and nurses and patients and so on. Computers are not traditionally very good at that. And so for years, we have as a field attempted to force humans into thinking like computers. And humans are not real good at that. Those of us who live in the technology fields, we have become accustomed to it because we've been trained for years and years to do it. So it seems like second nature to us to think about things in structured ways and to happily click through multiple pages of forms to put things in fields and things like that. But that's not really how most humans think, and it's not really how I think a lot of our physicians want to interact with their systems. So I believe that there's all sorts of opportunities in there for AI to help the computers meet the humans where the humans are, rather than forcing the humans to meet the computers where they are.
And so this is where sort of these large language models now come into play, right? These foundational or frontier models, like ChatGPT, for example, and even the advent of medical specific ones such as MedPalm-2. And how do you see that? How do you see these new models coming in to the sector? And do you think that, as you said, they'll maybe lower the bar, come closer to the way humans behave and interact versus making the humans sort of interact with the computers in a very rigid fashion?
Precisely. That is my hope for this category of technology. It's a very exciting category of technology. It really does offer potentials that we did not have even a year ago. ChatGPT came out November 30th, 22, I believe, and it really was a serious mic drop for the field. It changed a lot of the fundamentals of what we understand that we can do. And that's very exciting, and it does offer a lot of possibilities. So it begins to edge into this space where the technology can be more of an assistant and less of a pure response, in the sense that we can do things now like compose text on behalf of providers or summarize large complicated documents in ways that we couldn't before. One that a lot of people in the field are excited about is the ability to record an encounter, an appointment between a patient and a provider, and not simply transcribe it, which has medium value, but reduce the transcript to a very cogent summary, to the kind of note that a physician wants to have in their chart. And that is not something we've been capable of doing before, but that by itself would be an enormous time saver to physicians. We know that physicians are overwhelmed by documentation. They're overwhelmed in reading it, and they're overwhelmed in producing it. I think the statistic is that in a study that AthenaHealth did just last year, excessive documentation requirements were noted as one of the top two factors for physician burnout by over half of the respondents. And documentation, let's face it, nobody is really excited to do documentation. We need it to exist. Nobody is excited to do it. And physicians are especially not excited to do it when they've already gone home for the evening and have had dinner with their family and are putting their kids to bed and then have to spend 2 hours on their computer after that writing things up. So the vision that everyone would love to see is that the computer listens to the appointment and turns that into the documented note that then the physician or nurse or whoever can look at, spend 2 minutes to verify that it's right or make minor corrections, and then file it rather than having to spend 15 or 20 minutes to write it up from scratch. So that's the kind of assistance that we are seeing on the horizon now that offers the possibility to be a significant work assist and time saver to our clients.
And do you see that evolving even beyond, the scribe functionality to, because I think we're seeing this trend of large language models such as ChatGPT interfacing with other systems through APIs, for example. Do you see it sort of evolving sort of beyond that scribing functionality into furthering sort of the patient experience, if you will, helping to coordinate care and those kinds of things?
I think that's a possibility. It's a very exciting possibility. I think that we're at a very interesting time and we have to take it a little bit in baby steps because, as I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, there are also a lot of drawbacks to these language models, a lot of risks. And in healthcare especially, we need to be very wary of those risks. It's one thing if a large language model hallucinates something when you're asking it to compose an essay for your high school class. It's something of a different matter if it hallucinates something when it's giving care directions to a patient, right? That's something we cannot allow. And so we need to be very careful when we're talking about patient-facing applications. When they're provider-facing, we have the assurance that there's a human in the loop, an expert human who can read and correct the material. And so in the short term, we see things like assisting physicians in creating messages to patients so that the physician maybe doesn't have to write the whole thing out themselves. They can write out a stub that the model can then flesh out for them, and then they can verify and send. But now you crucially have this expert human in the loop. Whereas if you're talking about doing something that's directly patient-facing without having a human in the loop, becomes much, much more dangerous, and you have to have much higher levels of assurance that the model is not going to hallucinate or make a recommendation that goes against what the physician or nurse would recommend, and so on. I think there are definitely opportunities, and the field is definitely evolving. Everybody's aware of these problems, and there's enormous effort going into improving the state of affairs so that we can tackle things like what we would love to have is the system be able to do first level triage kinds of interactions with the patient so that the patient could talk first to the AI agent and have it handle the most basic things, right? Because people will call up their doctor's office and say things like, how many Tylenol should I take? Okay, well, it's a legit medical question, but it's also on the bottle, right? Do we really need to take up your provider's staff time answering that question? Can we triage that out? Can we triage out things like, should I make an appointment to come in next week or in a month versus do I need to go to urgent care this moment? Sometimes those decisions can be made easily, or sometimes it can be, this is something that absolutely needs to be escalated to a human being. And those are kinds of things that I think could be very helpful to patients as well as providers. I think people are very interested in working in that space. I'm not sure we're quite there yet, but you can sort of see it on the horizon. But I think we're being speculative here, right? But I think it's a speculation that everybody's very interested in, is working very hard on making real.
And so how would, a system be able to do that? Would you need to provide sort of guardrails in some way, shape, or form, saying, if it's a risk of such as of below a certain level, then, the models can respond. If not, it needs to refer to a doctor's office, or?
That would be the idea that you have, all provider contact, points of contact, your front office staff, your nurses, your providers, they essentially have a protocol. Many times it's explicit, like they have an explicit triage protocol. Sometimes it's implicit. But basically they know where you need to route a person and under what conditions you need to escalate or things like that. What we need is essentially a computational version of the very first tier of that protocol. Once you get beyond the first tier, you absolutely need human involvement. But at the first tier of the protocol, there's a lot that can be handled in relatively automated ways. The challenge is having the judgment to understand when you're within that first tier of the protocol and when you've moved out into places where you really need human involvement. And the truth is that generative models at the moment do not actually have judgment. They do a very good job of pretending to have judgment, but fundamentally they don't have judgment. They're just synthesizing text. They're being, as one person described it, they're being crispy autocomplete. We needed to have a higher tier of judgment. Can you achieve that with guardrails? Possibly. Can you achieve it with clever prompting and prompt engineering? Possibly. I think we're experimenting in those spaces. Can you achieve it with better, finely tuned, medically aware language models? Possibly. But all of these things are still open questions in my mind. The field is large and rich. Probably, I'm sure somebody out there is working on it. Have they licked the problem? Potentially. I'm not aware of it. But I know that there are challenges, but also a lot of eager people working in this space. In my mind, honestly, I think generative language models are extremely exciting and extremely powerful, but they're also still extremely limited. And I think people don't appreciate the ways in which they're limited. And I hope that we see more innovation in the space of improving their ability to have actual judgment, improving their ability to understand what is true and what is not true, and understand when they're falsifying. They currently have no way to do that. They literally don't know when they're lying to you because they have no notion of truth built into them. So I hope that people who are doing the fundamental research at the moment will be tackling those kinds of fundamental issues, because I don't think at the end of the day you can fully handle all of them with guardrails and add-ons at the end. I think it needs to come at a fundamental level in the way the model is designed and built from the ground up.
And do you think that's larger models, or is it more of a model design? Because I think we're already up to, 175 billion parameters?
That we know of in the public. Probably there's more.
Okay. Right.
And I think, didn't Palm 2 hit 500 billion parameters or something?
500, yeah.
Something like that.
Things are moving so quickly, it's hard to keep up.
Absolutely, it is. I think the argument about scale versus architecture remains open. There are definitely strong advocates on either side of that. For myself, I tend to believe more in the architecture side, that I believe there needs to be some fundamental improvements in the way that models are designed from the ground up, that they need a mechanism inside them to do things like judgment, reasoning, understanding of truth, ethical compass, moral compass, things like that. There are, however, very strong advocates on the other side who say, no, it's all about the data. And I've seen some pretty impressive things just done with either more data or more sophisticated shaping of the data that goes in. So it may be that those folks, you know, that camp of people are right, and maybe at the end of the day, it will simply be a matter of data. For myself, I'm skeptical of that, but I think it's an open question. I don't think anybody on Earth knows the answer to that question at the moment. If they did, they would have solved it already. There are many strong feelings, but I don't think we have actual scientific proof.
So it's that data curation element that is so critical then.
I think data curation is an extremely important facet of this. And we've seen the AI ethics community raise a number of important points and red flags about the impact of data and the choice of data and the availability of data on the way that AI models behave. And I think that, you know, even when you look at the way that ChatGPT was constructed, yes, they started by essentially vacuuming up the entire web. But in addition, they layered in instruction tuning and reinforcement learning from human feedback, both of which give a lot of shaping to the behavior of the model through very carefully selected applications of data. And that those two facets have been a big part, in my understanding, of how ChatGPT is able to do what it does. Beyond that, the people who are coming out with a lot of medical and healthcare related models now are doing a lot of it through the choice of data that they push into them. But we also know that these models, because you dump the entire internet into them, they've absorbed a lot of bias, they've absorbed a lot of hate. And to their credit, companies like OpenAI and Google and so on have done a very good job at sheltering us from that through guardrails and through post checks and things like that. But fundamentally, that stuff is still there inside the models. And if you're a little bit clever in your prompt engineering, you can expose that. And there have been many examples, if you go looking for them, of ways that you can expose that bias that's cooked into the data. I think that data, if we can find a way to be much more selective about our data, to be more balanced in who it represents and avoid a lot of the hate and bias and prejudices that are cooked into the web as a whole, I think we can make our models a lot smarter in that way. But even so, it's not quite the same as having a fundamental notion of ethics built in, or a fundamental notion of fairness built in, which is something that I think the field as a whole needs to achieve over time. And absolutely in the healthcare field, we need. In the healthcare field, we cannot afford to have our models making biased decisions. We can't afford it to perhaps generate hate speech at a patient, right? That would be just, that's not an acceptable outcome. But even without generating hate speech, we know that, for example, many medical conditions are prominent, other medical conditions are much more rare. If the model understands the prominent ones but not the rare ones, if those rare ones are correlated with certain demographics or certain communities, then maybe those communities get underserved by our AI systems, right? That's a potential in there. And I think that we need our models to be much smarter in order to correct for those things that are sort of sparsity in the real world or sparsity due to healthcare inequities in the U.S. healthcare system that have led certain groups to be undertreated. All of those things, we cannot simply let the data speak for itself in the raw way. We need to be a little bit more proactive in compensating for these sources of bias and unfairness in the world.
Right. And do you think, you know, that sort of codifying, the risk of codifying inequalities within models, right? And do you think that, you know, for example, is sort of synthetic data a way to address that by using generative AI to help, you know, sort of address underrepresentation in training sets?
That's a very interesting question. One does wonder if you've got the snake eating its tail at that point, because if the generative AI already has the bias and the underrepresentation cooked into it, can you really expect to use it to generate data in a compensatory way? Possibly, you know, through good prompt engineering, you might be able to get it to provide, to essentially boost up kind of rarer underrepresented populations or something. So that's a possibility. Certainly people have shown in the AI ethics community that with careful study of your data and careful balancing of the data, you can make significant improvements in the way that models in general behave, not just large language models, but AI in general behaves. And can you do it with synthesized data? Probably. I don't know that branch of the literature well enough to know what people have done in that space. I'm sure that people have done it. I don't know what they've done in that space, but I do know that people have done things like rebalancing real world data to great success.
So yeah, we've touched on some of the challenges there with these models. If you had sort of a crystal ball, how do you foresee things unfolding in the next, I don't know, 2 to 3 years or 5 years out? It's quite difficult with the pace of development, but do you have sort of any sort of thoughts on where we're headed and in the future?
I have many, many thoughts. The caveat I always have to give is the old Dutch saying that making predictions is hard, especially about the future. And you're absolutely right. The pace of change is simply astounding at the moment. People talk about the fire hose of information, but at the moment it's not a fire hose. It's more like standing under Niagara Falls. It's just amazing how fast things are changing, how much stuff is coming out. I recently looked at Archive, the site where a lot of preprints for technical papers come out, and looking within the machine learning space on Archive, I saw one day a couple of weeks ago that had 154 new papers. 154 new papers in one day. That's an indication just of the pace of what's going on at the moment. So given that, what can you say about 1 year, 3 year, 5 year out? Very difficult to say. I can say some trends that I see people working on. All of these kinds of shortcomings that we've talked about and risks that we've talked about, people are all aware of them, right? This is not news. Lots of people are working on improving them through lots of different approaches. And I think that's very important that people are aware of risks like hallucinations, like bias, like lack of reasoning and things like that. And I do see papers coming out and people working very hard on a number of these things. So there's definitely effort in those areas, and I hope that that will make improvements to the fundamentals of these systems. Another challenge point that we're facing at the moment is capacity. These things run on very high-end GPU hardware. There's simply not enough of it to go around. Plus, it's very power-hungry. When you look at the pricing models for things like ChatGPT or Palm or so on, they're not cheap. And when you're trying to do it at the scale of an enterprise like Athena Health, where we're doing something like, we see something like a quarter of the U.S. population every year in one way or another, passing through providers that we deal with. When you're dealing with data of that scale, you can't afford to spend a fifth of a cent per encounter on computation. And we're not the only ones, right? Many, many, many people out there have use cases that they would love to do at enormous scale, but you simply can't afford to right at the moment. There's enormous pressure to make the models cheaper, to make them run more efficiently and lower power. There's a lot of work in custom hardware. There's a lot of work in model distillation and things like that. That's a story we've seen play out before, and we know how it goes. You know, we watch Moore's Law over the past few decades. Moore's Law, in some sense, has flattened out, but I think we are still very, very good at a field at optimizing for cost and hardware capability. So as long as there remains pressure on doing that, I think we will see significant improvements on that front in the next few years. What I'm most interested in is, right, so those are things that are going to apply much more generally to the field as a whole. What I'm sort of interested in at the moment is, where are we going to go in the healthcare field? And that's an interesting question because it really does depend on how the fundamentals of these things evolve. But I do feel like there's a lot of opportunity here to do many things. One is to help providers weed through the enormous amount of information that flows into them. Somebody at one point described it as, my EHR gives me an encyclopedia when sometimes all I want is like one dictionary entry or something like that. There's just so much information flying at them that they can't really process all of it. So having a system that can help distill it, can help focus attention on the really relevant information, the things that they actually care about and are actionable, that is a hope that I see coming in the next few years. Simultaneously, as we talked about earlier, the ability to reduce paperwork burden, the ability to help smooth out the interaction between the human and the computer, to allow, as we said before, to allow the human to do the human job in the human way and let the computer worry about the other side of it. I do see a lot of pressure for that to happen because this, again, is a known pain point in the healthcare industry. I see certainly us at Athena, and what you see in the public announcements from other vendors, is that there's a lot of attention on making capabilities like that available to help make it easier and simpler for the providers to do their job and to take a lot of that administrative work and a lot of that documentation work and a lot of the rote text generation work off their plates. So I believe we'll see that kind of thing in the near horizon, up to our ability to make it work given the kinds of risks and constraints that we talked about earlier, but certainly a lot of pressure to make it work. So if it's feasible, I think it will happen.
Yeah, and I think that there's tremendous, some estimates out there in terms of the administrative burden being in billions, right? Hundreds of billions.
Hundreds of billions. One estimate I saw said that the U.S. healthcare system spends something like $380 billion a year on administration. And that's a really astounding and terrifying number. I like to put it in context with a different statistic I ran into a few months ago. So there is this program that the U.S. government started under President George W. Bush, the PEPFAR program, which was to assist developing nations in Africa through the AIDS crisis. And the U.S. brought in experts and materials and drugs, and we made a huge impact on the AIDS crisis in Africa. So that program is credited with saving about 25 million lives in Africa over the last 20 years. It's cost us about $110 billion over those same 20 plus years. So $110 billion saved 25 million lives over 20 years. In the U.S., we're spending $380 billion a year just on administration. There seems to me to be a significant gap in the value proposition of these two things. Now, it's sort of comparing apples to oranges, right? They're very different kinds of things, but they're still within the healthcare space. And it does put in context to you just what a large number we're talking about when we talk about the cost of administration in the U.S. And so to the degree that we can use any technology up to and including AI to pull those administrative burdens down, I think that's going to be a major win for everybody, for the physicians, for their staff, for the patients, for the payers, for our taxpayers. All of us are involved in this, and we're all paying that $380 billion price tag. So if we can reduce that price tag, everybody wins.
Yeah, and perhaps, you know, some of the ROI generated in that space will help to bolster cases for further development of AI.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, there's so many possibilities. So when you talk about the 5-year and further horizon, I have a lot of dreams, let us say, very speculative dreams, but I would love to see a day in which the technology can really be seamless and vanish into the background and be a genuine assistant to a provider. It can be the thing that you don't have to think about, you don't have to fight with, but it's just there and it provides you the information you need it when you need it. It acts on your requests and orders in very natural, human-centric ways without requiring inordinate numbers of mouse clicks and details and things like that, because it has a fundamental understanding that lets it bridge the gap from the way that a human would describe it to the way that we need it to be in the lowest level of the data layers. And so I would love to see us in a place where the technology is not an obstruction, but is an active assistant in all facets of the healthcare system, not just in the provider's office, but for individuals at home, right? That potentially you could have an active assistant that could help you as a patient understand your health treatment plan, adhere to your health treatment plan, help you understand symptoms that you're feeling and when you should be in contact with the doctor's office, mediate those contacts, things like that. That's a pretty grand vision, but I'll say that it's the kind of vision that, for example, Apple has had for decades of making the technology very, very transparent and making it focused on the user experience, not on the technology. And I'll just say that strategy has worked pretty well for them. Now, I'm not on the product end of our company, so I can't actually say anything about which direction we're actually going to go. But as a technologist, it is something that I would love to see us strive for technologically and make the capabilities to make that kind of thing a reality.
Well, that's a great dream.
I dream big, but it may take a while to get there.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming on to speak with us and giving us your insights and your vision for the future. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's been truly delightful to be here. Thank you for a lovely conversation.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.